This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, trouble for refugees along the Hungarian border. A second U.S. Republican presidential debate to take center stage. Nepal struggles to revive mountain tourism.
We are repairing the trails, bridges, and...
Hello again from Washington. We have two interesting stories for you on today's edition of As It Is.
Stick around. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Serbia says it is not able to handle the vast number of migrants gathered along the border with Hungary after Hungarian officials closed the crossing point as part of a crackdown on the migrants. Serbia's Foreign Minister Ivica Dačić called it unacceptable for migrants to have to return to Serbia, especially as more arrive from Greece and Macedonia. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban said under new security measures that took effect Tuesday, his administration will be tough on those who cross the border illegally. VOA's Aisha Tanzim is on the scene and spoke earlier with International Edition's Jim Stevenson.
I was at the Hungarian side of the border, mostly in the border villages of Reske and Moratalam, and trying to figure out whether Hungarian government is seriously implementing its policy of illegal border crossings and stopping them. And what I realized was that the government is indeed extremely serious. The police presence today in border towns was much heavier than what we have seen in the last few days. The army was also visibly present, although in a supporting role. And what we saw was that the same roads where we could see migrants, a steady stream of them walking by the side of the road, there was nobody there. There was a group of Afghan men that we saw in one town, Moratalam, and I asked them where they were coming from. They were confused and they didn't know what to do. And that's almost a very common story here. A lot of people just don't know what to do and where to go, and they're just following each other. This side of Hungarian border, very heavy police presence. The other side of the Hungarian border, we could hear crowds gathering. We could hear them chanting, no food, no water, Germany, just open the door. They were asking our Arabic translator where to go, where the entry point was. But the government has made it very clear that apart from two entry points, one at Tampa and one at Rishke, both villages, no other place will be considered entry point for migrants. The confusion I have found is overwhelming. Most of the times, people just cannot get through to each other. The authorities here, the migrants speaking the Arabic, the authorities here speaking Hungarian, very few people speaking English. There's just confusion all around.
Did you get a sense that some migrants are actually getting through those two entry points?
I talked to the UN spokesperson, Babar Baloch, today, and he said that their information was that the registration process was on again, off again. So it was starting, then stopping, then resuming again. Nobody had a clear sense of how many people got through.
For those stuck on the Serbian side of the border and crying out for food and water, is there any indication that perhaps aid is coming their way while they're stuck?
Yes, the people who are at certain points on the Serbian side of the border, particularly on these border crossings that are closed, there was Red Cross there today, there was MSF, there was Save the Children, and there were some other local charities. Now, if people are coming through for some in-between points where they're trying to cross the fence through some other route, then I doubt that they have aid, and they're probably walking through the fields and picking and eating whatever they can find in the fields. We saw some migrants with grapes in their hands. Some migrants told us that they were just eating apples from the fields, because you do see some fruit and some vegetables in the fields around. There are corn fields around, but it's not exactly clear that there's any aid other than at certain points.
VOA's Aisha Tanzim speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. The main highway from Serbia to Hungary has been turned into a fortified front line. The migrants are marooned in Serbia, unsure of where to go and what to do. Henry Ridgewell has more from the Flashpoint border crossing of Horgios, Serbia.
As the numbers build, so does the tension. Fathers raised their children above the barbed wire in silent protest. Hungary's critics call the fence Fortress Europe and say it has no place in the 21st century. But Hungary says it is simply enforcing European Union laws. Opposition leader and former Hungarian Prime Minister Ferenc Gyurcsány came to see the chaos.
It's outrageous. It's so unhuman that it cannot be believed. As the mass of people is growing and growing, the tension is growing and growing, who knows how long it can be maintained, can be managed.
Legal asylum applications will now be processed at official crossing points like Roszke. But Hungarian lawmaker Timea Szabo told VOA she had witnessed irregularities in the few applications accepted.
On the asylum application, under crossing the border, the means of crossing the border, it says illegally, and they make, the asylum officers make these asylum seekers sign this paper. So there's already something absolutely outrageous happening at the border, and this is only the first day.
There is growing anger, and many fear the situation could turn violent. More migrants are arriving by the hour, their flight from war or poverty halted on the very edge of Europe by a razor wire fence. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News on the Hungarian-Serbian border.
As refugees from the Middle East, Africa and South Asia pour into Europe, we have seen both gestures of welcome and refusal. One group of people, among which some see this wave of humanity flooding Europe as a positive development, are people who study the makeup and impact of populations. International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with researcher Marley Morris at the Institute for Public Policy in London about how the influx of refugees is viewed by some as a kind of blessing in disguise because it could replenish the population of an aging continent.
I think there's a good case to be made for that. I think if you look at countries like Germany, like Spain, they are aging populations, they are shrinking populations, and they really do need migrants in order to sustain their economies for the coming years. So, in many ways, you know, these countries do need these migrants, and I think that's partly why some countries like Germany are being quite welcoming in their attitude to the refugees that are arriving there.
We've heard for decades that as they get older, there's not enough replenishment. The birth rate has been so low that there's really not enough people growing up and becoming part of the society to do the jobs and also to pay into the healthcare system and pay into the pension system. And this influx of migrants or refugees actually addresses that, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the two things that, you know, affect population growth are, you know, birth rates, death rates, and net migration. And so, you know, if you can't control the birth and death rates, then the best way to control the population growth and the shape and kind of age structure of that population is through migration. And, you know, a number of the migrants that are coming over to Europe are young, you know, they are entrepreneurial, they are hardworking, and they'll be able to pay into that tax system in order to really replenish you know, European economies.
And also the skill set. As you just mentioned, a lot of them do have a certain degree of education. They have real skills that belong in the marketplace, correct?
Oh, no, absolutely. That's true. You know, there are a number of graduates coming over, and there are a number of people who have middle skill sets that are really what many of these countries like Germany need in their labor market. So, you know, as long as the labor markets are able to integrate in these newcomers into their societies, then they will be able to help to sustain their economies.
Let's focus on the integration part. What do countries need to do as these refugees arrive on their borders and come into their countries? How do they bring them into the workplace, and how do they make them productive?
Well, I think the number one barrier to integration into the labor market is language, and, you know, in particular, being able to have the right language skills in order to ensure that migrants are able to work, are able to, you know, be able to be integrated into their communities. And, you know, the other key element is making sure that they have networks in their society. And many of these refugees won't, you know, necessarily have huge numbers of contacts. The migrant communities from Syria, you know, are relatively newly established. So they'll need to be able to really, you know, find networks with other communities in order to build those connections, in order to get into the labor market, in order to, you know, make contacts and networks throughout local communities across Europe.
Marley Morris is a researcher at the Institute for Public Policy Research in London, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Social media continues to buzz over the ongoing refugee crisis in Europe. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here to tell us about some of the hashtags people are using. G?
Hi, Ray. I mentioned Monday that hashtag Syrian refugees was used more often than both hashtag refugee crisis and hashtag migrant crisis combined, and that's still the case. In addition to those, there are a number of new hashtags people started using. And if you're the type to view the situation as a refugee and not a migrant crisis, you'll be happy to see the new hashtags.
So are these new hashtags more sympathetic to these people?
Exactly. It really reflects a changing sentiment in Europe toward the migrant/refugee crisis. A case in point is hashtag refugees welcome. That hashtag was used in 14,000 tweets in the last 24 hours. But of course, there are always two sides to an issue. Hashtag refugees not welcome also exists, but it's not as popular. That hashtag was used in more than 700 tweets in the same time frame.
That's interesting. And anyone you've been following closely today?
Well, I'm still following updates from our reporters on location, but outside of our team of reporters, I'm really enjoying tweets from Melissa Fleming. She's a chief communications officer and spokesperson for the UNHCR, and her handle is at Melissa R. Fleming. Ray, her pinned tweet from July is a picture of a girl at a refugee camp in Iraqi Kurdistan, and along with the photo, Fleming tweeted, "She looked to me like she was carrying the entire weight of the Syrian civil war on her small shoulders." More than 1,000 people shared that tweet and marked it as a favorite about 700 times.
Well, that's an emotional tweet. How influential is her account?
Well, she has nearly 30,000 followers and tweets several times a day, so quite influential, I'd say. Ray?
Social media reporter G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. The U.S. Congress is considering lifting a ban on U.S. oil exports. Business correspondent Alexis Christophorus has details in New York.
House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy says the House is preparing to vote later this month to repeal a 40-year-old ban on the export of crude oil. The plan was immediately celebrated by the oil industry, but it's already drawing fire from environmental groups. The oil industry has started a major lobbying campaign to generate support in Washington for the repeal of the ban. It was first imposed during the 1970s oil crisis, a legislative effort that will face tougher opposition in the Senate. The American Petroleum Institute has started an ad campaign pushing the proposed repeal. It argues that allowing oil exports would actually reduce the price of gasoline by creating an incentive for continued new oil production in the U.S. at a time when the domestic oil glut has sent prices tumbling. Several refiners oppose lifting the ban because they fear the action will raise the price of domestic oil. Meantime, the White House has made clear it does not support the House legislation, saying the Commerce Department already has the authority to make adjustments in the policy.
Investors are also thinking about what might happen at the upcoming Federal Reserve meeting and how the markets might react.
We actually saw a nice rally for U.S. stocks, with the S&P 500 closing at its highest level in more than 2 weeks, up 1.3% to 1,978. And that's after a strong retail sales report showed a resilient consumer. Meanwhile, a quarterly survey says chief executive officers of large U.S. companies are becoming less optimistic about the prospects for the world's largest economy. More leaders are planning to cut capital spending and employment in the next 6 months. Meantime, speculation has increased the Fed will delay raising rates as China ignited concern that its slowdown could weigh on global growth. While investors remain confident the central bank will increase borrowing costs this year, traders are pricing in just a 30% chance of action on Thursday. That is down from 48% before China's currency devaluation last month. Odds of a move at the December Fed meeting are 62%.
VOA business correspondent Alexis Christophers in New York. U.S. politics will be focused on what's happening at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library Wednesday night, scene of the second nationally televised debate between Republican presidential contenders. 11 of them will be on stage, including the current frontrunner, real estate billionaire Donald Trump. VOA's Jim Malone has this preview.
Businessman Donald Trump!
Donald Trump will once again be the center of attention as Republicans hold their second debate.
Who cares? It doesn't matter.
Trump has expanded his lead in public opinion polls since the first debate last month, and he continues to make bold promises.
We will have so much winning if I get elected that you may get bored with winning. Believe me, I agree. You'll never get bored with winning. We never get bored.
Trump could face more criticism this time from his rivals, including another political outsider who's doing well in the polls, retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson.
If I listen to all the people throughout my life who said, "This has never been done before. This cannot be done," I wouldn't be talking to you today.
All right.
Former business executive Carly Fiorina will join the Republican debate field this time, another newcomer making headway at the expense of more experienced candidates like former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. Bush has been attacking Trump, but also pushing a new blueprint for the economy.
My plan for the entire economy will create a true revival of the private sector and 19 million new jobs.
Several of Trump's rivals hope to share the limelight in this next debate, including Texas Senator Ted Cruz, a leading opponent of the nuclear deal with Iran.
This Iranian nuclear deal is catastrophic. It is the single greatest national security threat facing America.
Trump's rivals will be looking for ways to attack him without alienating his supporters, says analyst Stuart Rothenberg.
We're at the point now where voters simply want to express frustration and anger and disappointment with the direction of the country, Republican voters' frustration with the president, and so they're looking for someone who gives them voice, and Donald Trump certainly does that.
The debates also provide candidates an opportunity to connect with voters, says Republican analyst Scott Faulkner.
And thinking on their feet is going to be an interesting moment, because right now they're all pretty much still just mouthing talking points and staying in their individual campaign bubbles.
Hillary Clinton and her Democratic challengers will hold their first debate next month. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, getting back up in the Himalayas. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Dementia affects some 35 million people around the world. Alzheimer's disease accounts for most dementia, but researchers in Europe say that large epidemiological studies are showing that the risk of dementia is decreasing as a result of dramatic changes in lifestyles. Dr. Laura Fertiglione with Sweden's Karolinska Institute says various factors can lessen the risk of dementia.
Non-smoking, moderate alcohol intake, physical activity, avoiding obesity, overweight, and doing all this starting from middle age.
And here's Professor Carol Brain at the University of Cambridge.
Older people are much more prone to changes in the blood vessels of the brain.
The researchers stress that there is no surefire way to prevent dementia, but anti-smoking efforts and healthier lifestyles starting at an earlier age are improving brain health. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
This is VOA's International Edition. 5 months after being devastated by a deadly earthquake, Nepal is struggling to revive mountain and trekking tourism, a vital source of jobs for the poor Himalayan country. Nepal's Taur mountain peaks have been a hotspot for climbers from around the world. Anjana Pasricha reports on Nepal's efforts to get the visitors back.
Ramesh Prasad Thamala of Ecological Treks in Nepal is excited as he prepares to welcome his first group of hikers since the deadly April 25th earthquake prompted thousands of mountaineers to pack up and leave.
We are sending the six German people, you know, to the mountain. Similarly, other companies, they are also doing. So there are a few trekkers. They already, you know, they're starting their trekking activities on the mountain. They are not worried. They are ready to go.
These men and women are among a handful of foreign climbers who are braving Nepal's mountains this autumn after setting aside concerns about the instability of popular trails following the earthquake in the high Himalayas. It is a huge step forward as the country tries to woo back the more than 150,000 hikers who come every year to scale its peaks or trek in the tall mountains. The earthquake struck at the height of the spring climbing season and sent these foreign climbers scurrying back. 19 people died after an avalanche struck Mount Everest and some popular trekking trails were damaged. Ang Shering, the president of the Nepal Mountaineering Association, says in recent months they have worked hard to open up the mountains for visitors.
We are repairing the trails, bridges and route heads. Some of the places we are putting the retention walls where there are landslides. We are very much sure that this will be very stable. The tea houses and lodges are not much affected.
The efforts are paying off. After an assessment, a California-based engineering firm hired to address concerns of safety found trails around Mount Annapurna safe for hikers. It is due to give a report on Everest shortly. The two mountains account for about 70% of the climbers and hikers who head to Nepal. That has raised hopes among nearly 200,000 Sherpas, guides, porters, and others that 2016 will be a better year. With the spring climbing season shattered by the earthquake, many of them had no income this year, but they hope the lure of the mountains will draw visitors back. The proof of that attraction is Japanese climber Nobukazu Kuriki, who is the first person setting out to conquer Everest after the earthquake. He begins his climb next month in a season that is far more challenging than spring. A group of Sherpas has begun repairing a treacherous stretch on the route known as the Khumbu Icefall, which was destroyed in the earthquake. Kuriki says his mission is to contribute to the revival of mountain tourism and send out a message, Nepal is safe. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Probably the biggest female pop star today is Taylor Swift. If you have some doubts about that, maybe you'll be convinced after hearing what VOA border crossing host Larry London had to say during a chat with my colleague, Susan Yockey.
Taylor Swift seems to continue to find ways to get in the mainstream and in the headlines and whatever it is she's doing, for better or for worse. The latest bit of news about Taylor, there's a couple of things. First of all, congratulations to Taylor on getting 9 nominations.
Outstanding.
9 nominations for the MTV Europe Awards, which will be handed out in October in Milan, Italy. She just came off of a big win at the MTV Video Music Awards here in the U.S. She got the Video of the Year Award, and so now she's up for 9 in Europe. She was named the most popular person, the most followers on social media, with 46.5 million followers on Instagram and 63.5 million followers on Twitter. And her 1989 album is the best-selling album of the year so far. Her earnings this past year, $80 million this past year alone, just in this 1 year. Now she's got a new song.
You know, I bet
now.
She has a nice place.
I bet she's got a few nice places. A few, as a matter of fact. But her new song is called Wildest Dreams. And this features a different look at Taylor because now she's colored her hair black. And she's taken on the persona of a 1940s film star. A lot of people are connecting her to the look of Elizabeth Taylor in her new video, Wildest Dreams, which is great. It's a great song, and it's another hit off the 1989 album.
You know, I think she's been hot since she first came onto the scene. I've really enjoyed her music. And one thing I like about her is she has not been raunchy. She hasn't made her fame based on raunchiness. She has real talent, real good look. She's a great dancer. And she's extremely successful.
Yes, she's a good role model, which the music industry has few of. And not only that, she's made the turn from country music to pop music with the new album. This is a very big change for her and her career, and it was a gamble. Her record company were not in favor of this move, but it's turned out successful.
And sometimes we see stars like this that you can see they're going to start to fade. You're going to see, ah, this fad's over with. She's out. But I don't see anywhere that she's dipping at all.
Yeah, she's managed to put her finger on the pulse of music no matter what she does. And, you know, the world is her oyster. Is that what they say?
Yes.
You know, I mean, she's got a big, bright future. She's about to head to Asia for her tour in the fall. So she's getting excited about that, going to China and other places throughout Asia. So it's been a great year for Taylor Swift, and we'll see what happens with the new song.
Well, thank you, Larry, for stopping by.
Thank you, Susan.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. Visit our website for more news, information, and videos at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In early September, the U.S. Department of State named as designated global terrorists four men who pose threats to international stability. These designations mean that no U.S. citizen may trade or conduct business of any kind with these men. Also, it allows the United States to freeze their assets, lock them out of the global financial network, and prosecute them for terrorist activities. Samir Kuntar is a Lebanese citizen. In 1979, at the age of 16, Kuntar led four members of the Palestinian Liberation Front, a U.S. Department of State-designated foreign terrorist organization, on a mission to kidnap an Israeli family. The mission failed, and the group took as hostages of opportunity a young Israeli father and his four-year-old daughter. In the course of committing this crime, the terrorists willfully killed both hostages and two police officers. Two of the terrorists died. Kuntar was wounded, arrested, tried for murder, and found guilty. Kuntar was released from prison in 2008, was welcomed by Hezbollah, a U.S. Department of State-designated foreign terrorist organization, and has become one of the group's most visible and popular spokesmen. With the assistance of Iran and Syria, Kuntar has helped to build up Hezbollah's terrorist infrastructure in the Golan Heights. Three active operatives of the Hamas terrorist organization have also been designated global terrorists. Yahya Sinwar and Rawahi Mushtaha are founding members of the forerunner to the Izzedine al-Qassam Brigades, the military arm of Hamas. Their compatriot, Muhammad Deif, has participated in violent activities against Israeli citizens since the mid-1990s. He was involved in deadly bombings of civilian buses, kidnapped Israeli soldiers, and has planned and ordered numerous suicide bombings which have taken the lives of dozens of civilians. By naming Samir Kuntar, Yahya Sinwar, Rohi Mushtaha, and Muhammad Deif as specially designated global terrorists, the United States is taking a decisive step toward ensuring that they and the terrorist organizations with which they are affiliated find it ever more difficult to carry out their acts of violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's for